Welcome to episode 26 of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. I've been pretty much out of action this week, trying to get rid of the bug which I recently picked up, so as a result, I didn't manage to get anything recorded on location as I'd planned. This week's show instead features another conversation with photographer and writer Hugh Graham, who was one of my lecturers when I studied at university. You regular listeners will of course recognise Hugh's name from episode 21, when we discussed photographic education. On this occasion, we're taking the following as our opening question. If you can photograph a wedding, does that mean you can photograph just about any kind of social photography assignment? And as our conversation progresses, we also ask, at what point does the photographer's direct interaction with his or her subject mean that the resulting photographs cannot be seen to be an accurate record of events as they actually happen? So, getting straight on with things, welcome, one and all, to The Active Photographer, episode 26. Here again with Hugh Graham, and we're going to talk today about social photography, that is working with people, producing pictures of people. But let's start off, Hugh, with this idea that if you shoot weddings, the belief that if you can shoot weddings successfully time and time again and get the results that your clients are happy with, if you can master wedding photography, you are well set to master any sort of photojournalism or any sort of photography that involves essentially people management.
Okay. But before we begin that, Giles, I'd like you to tell me what you think social photography is.
Okay. My take on it is pretty much almost exactly what I was just saying. That to me, social photography is when you are recording images of people going about their day-to-day life, or when you're recording, if it is a wedding or an event, anything where people are involved as your main subject and you're trying to get a story across.
Okay, so it's not portraiture?
Not in the sense that I would immediately see it. Okay. I would see a slight variation of that theme so when it comes to portraiture.
So the pictures in social photography are not shot in a studio with a black studio on a chair smiling.
That's not what I immediately think of when I think of social photography.
Okay.
I think that's a
when
tangent
you,
topic.
When you were at university, what did they say that social photography was? Because it seemed to me that when you were at university, they used to get confused with reportage. That was a wonderful word that no one actually knew what it meant. People were sometimes described as photojournalists, and they didn't know what that meant either.
Mm.
Photojournalism became a buzzword for press photography,
mm.
which is actually rubbish, because it isn't.
Mm.
Photojournalism, in my view, is somebody who writes and takes pictures, or takes pictures and writes,
mm.
and someone who actually produces an illustrated photo feature for a newspaper, magazine or book, and actually supplies both the words and the pictures.
Mm.
That's a photojournalist, and most people get worried about this. Social photography, yeah, fine. Okay, so the other phrase that was used in most colleges was documentary photography. I never really understood that either.
Mm.
So what is what do you think documentary photography is?
It's telling a story using the camera as your device to record that story, to literally document. Now, I had a conversation when I was doing a one-year foundation course before doing my degree, and my tutor at the time there, we kind of were all sat around the table, and it's like there was this the question of is every photograph a document? You're giving me a wry smile. It's a typical kind of college stroke university lecturer's question. Technically, yes, every photograph is a document. It is documenting something. It is a reference of something, and that could apply to a vase of flowers in a studio, or it could be a war zone or what have you. But documentary photography, I always picture that applying more to the real world.
Okay.
To life's activities. Now, people often think of war zones, or people think of political rallies and that sort of thing. Whether in the public's eye, documentary photography has a harder edge to it, maybe?
I think, okay, so we're talking roughly, I think we're singing from the same hymn sheet. So documentary photography could actually be a production of a book about a particular subject, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It could be, for example, a year in Provence. It could be life down a coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a farmer's year. It could be all sorts of things like that. But it can also be, can't it, a short, sharp photo feature in either a magazine or in a newspaper article, perhaps in one of the weekend broadsheets.
Yeah.
All right. So, in what way does it differ now to what it was in the past?
The documentary photography.
Yeah.
How does it differ? I mean, there's the immediacy with which images, just as soon as they have been captured, can be shared.
Yeah.
Which was never there in the past. But that's all just relative. It's you move with the technology.
Mm.
There were people in the bunkers in the war who were using old tin pans and, you know, developing their film in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was as quick as they could do it. And essentially,
they were coming back by carrier pigeon too.
Yeah, so it was kind of the forerunner. Were they really? I didn't know that. They sent stuff back by...
Roger Fenton used to send his pictures back by...
I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. I'll have to look that up. For those of you listening, I'll do some research and I'll put a link in the show notes so you can see.
You want to have a look at Roger Fenton's work in the Crimea.
Okay.
And he was the first war photographer.
So, hang on. In terms of where... See, my sense of history is not that great. The war in the Crimea, was that before the American Civil War or after? Because
just after.
So what about Matthew Brady then?
What about him?
Well, he's considered to be one of the forefathers of...
But he wasn't before Roger Fenton. And Fenton's pictures appeared in the Times.
Okay.
Which was then called the Thunderer.
So Roger Fenton, there was it he who did the pictures of the cannonballs?
Yeah.
It's a very well-known picture.
That's right.
And...
That's in the Charge of the Light Brigade, I think you're thinking of.
Yes, and it looks like a pumpkin field, but yes. They're not pumpkins; they are
cannonballs.
Yeah. Okay, and this actually inadvertently has kind of tapped into this idea of not the issue of whether the camera lies, because that's we'll maybe touch on that later. But I know that Matthew Brady would get dead troops and arrange them in the pictures to help aesthetically with the pictures.
Roger Fenton had it much easier. He had lots of dead people around anyway.
Yeah.
And so he had an endless supply of dead people.
So you'd see the same people appearing in different pictures to the point where they change the uniforms and what have you. So, okay. So going back to the question of...
If you actually don't want to talk about that, you know... Kappa's picture of the
Spanish
soldier. There's been endless arguments of whether that was posed or not.
And that came to light again a year or so back, and people are up in arms again about whether it was
genuine or not.
For those that you don't know, there's this Spanish Civil War soldier. It looks as though he's taken a shot to the chest or what have you, and he's sort of falling back. He's on a hillside. Lots of people have questioned this. Lots of people have gone to the scene, done some reference shots and said, well, actually, the caption that's always been associated with it, the description doesn't match up because the mountains or the land in the background is not where they say it is. The way that the guy's falling isn't systematic with how someone would fall if they'd taken... All these questions.
But then exactly the same people were asking... it's almost like the ongoing conspiracy theory.
Mm.
If you look at Rosenthal's picture of the Marines raising the flag on Guadalcanal,
oh yeah,
there's a huge amount of controversy on that, and said that was a setup. Rosenthal himself said it was.
Yeah.
And it was, but it doesn't make any difference. It's a superb picture which captured the moment.
So this is where what you might consider documentary photography, literally standing back recording a scene, then crosses over into illustrative for effect.
No, I'd argue that. So, I think every photographer everywhere has always looked for the ideal spot.
Yeah,
which is arranging something, isn't it? So you're going to look for the angle, you're going to choose where you're going to shoot from, which means you're going to position the object, doesn't it? So I don't think it makes any difference.
So, okay. So if... Because that's a very good example that you've brought up there with the troops raising the flag. And my take on it when I was reading something not so long ago about how he kind of saw... the shot, he saw sort of the hill and he could see the troops were kind of making their way up and were there, and that at that point he thought, you know, that would be an excellent shot to have them doing this. He must have at that point said to those troops, look, I want to give the sense of, you know, in the face of all this sort of, you know,
no, it's much simpler than this. He shot a picture of the flagpole being, which was a piece of drainpipe, being raised vertically, and he thought, I'm not sure whether I've got that. I want to do it again.
Mm.
So that's how it happened.
So again, so if we strip it down into this belief that documentary photography is recording events as they happen, would you therefore maintain that is? Not that it's never going to be the case, because I know that when I've photographed weddings with you, for example, in the past, the bride and groom aren't, that they might know that you're there, but they're not changing their behaviour.
No.
If you're doing a long lens shot of them walking up a churchyard, you just say, look, carry on walking, and they're still going to be talking. So you're not, other than you've, but then I suppose I've answered my own question, haven't I? You've told them to walk up that path.
Sure, you've arranged it.
So
you have seen that's going to be a pleasant scene, it's going to get the romance of their relationship into the photograph. And if the picture doesn't tell a story, I mean, Harry Bartholomew, when he was editor of the Daily Mirror just after 1900, said that he was the first person to say a good picture is worth 1,000 words, and it is. But the picture has to tell a story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that will require either envisioning it in the first place, or putting the people in the picture to do whatever to, or for you to move around so that you can get the image you want.
So is there anything wrong with setting up a shot? If it's a shot that is, for argument's sake, from the front lines, for say the Times or the Telegraph or what have you, is there anything wrong with, in this day and age, setting it up?
I don't think so. And certainly that was done in Tiananmen Square during the Chinese riots.
Yeah.
And I think if you talk to any war photographer, they will all tell you that they have arranged pictures. They, of course, shot lots of pictures while they were happening. Some of the best pictures of all were shot. If you look at Magnus' pictures of the landing on D-Day, where some of the pictures shot by Capra, I think. Where they were hopelessly out of focus because, after all, the bullets were flying around and his Leica was in and out of the water. They captured the moment, though. They were pictures that you and I on a normal day would reject because they were either poorly focused or poorly shot or were just actually full of movement.
One of the greatest award-winning shots I ever saw was going back probably about sort of 8 years ago. And it was something like the World Press Photo Awards or one of these. And the guy that won it, he was covering some war zone thing. And there was all this shelling was taking place. And him and all his other journalists were just running, literally running for their lives. And his camera was swinging around by his knees. And he accidentally knocked it with his knee. And it shot off a couple of shots. On, like, literally from knee level on a slight angle,
purely through, I suppose, the autofocus kicked in, or maybe he had it set to focus on sort of a certain distance at, say, f8 or f11 or what have you, and everything was nicely sharp.
Talking about the hyperfocal distance again,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, so that was not a premeditated shot. That was, but it was truthful in that it was captured in the height of the action, but he won an award. And I remember there was a bit of feedback about this. He won this award for a shot that he never expected or planned to take.
But then I think if you actually were to analyse it, Josh, nearly every award is won in exactly the same way. How many of your best pictures were a surprise?
Oh, yeah, happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, exactly. So, you look at the pictures and think, oh, that's rather good. I don't remember taking that.
Mm.
And, yeah, well, it happens to all of us.
Oh, you shoot, you do a day's...
But then this is because your intuition tells you when to take the shutter, to trip the shutter at the right time.
Mm.
This is when you're so familiar with the camera that you are unaware of the fact that you've operated the controls.
Mm.
It's a bit like driving.
Mm.
You have no clear recollection of changing gear or steering around corners on a journey of 5 or 6 miles. You just get there. And photography is much the same. Once you understand the camera properly and you are totally familiar with its controls and the relationship between shutter speed and aperture, then it happens automatically.
And this, I think, is something, therefore, that's at the root of any, broadly speaking, then social, documentary, wedding, whatever, photography, is that because it is, as we've said, 80-90% people skills and then 20 or 10% technical, you don't have to worry about how do I synchronize shutter speed with aperture to get, you know, that your camera's going to do what you want it to do, because you've learned how to do that, so you can concentrate on the content.
I don't think that you can be a successful social photographer, whatever that means, until you are able to until you are completely familiar with your camera controls, and you know exactly what certain focal lengths do, what certain apertures do, and what certain shutter speeds do.
Mm.
Once you know, roughly speaking, what your camera will do, then you can actually get on with taking pictures, and you can stop worrying about how you're going to control the camera.
Mm.
And I think that I think it was Bailey who said, I wish we could have a magic finger where you just push the finger down and you got the picture you saw in your head.
Mm.
Well, I think that's roughly what social photography is.
Mm.
You see a whole series of images which collectively or perhaps individually tell a story.
Mm.
And once you've seen them, it's your job to get them somehow into an image which can produce a print.
So, and this, I mean, if you think about camera settings for a moment, the difference potentially between using a spot metering mode as opposed to a centuated or evaluative reading, you can change the dynamic of a picture beyond all recognition just by, for example, using the spot reading, taking a highlight off of someone's forehead, drops the background into shadow, and it makes it a more powerful shot. There's that, what's his name? The chap who, very famous picture, is it Tim McCurry? The guy that took the girl with a very, the really sort of strong eyes and what have you. There's no distraction in that shot because the background is neutral.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, it was natural light.
Yeah.
But regardless of whether you're using natural light or flash, what have you, if you are tailoring the shot using those exposure metering modes, then that is, like you'd say, is envisioning, that is putting down on paper, as it were, your image that you see in your head.
Now, I know that you use Nikon cameras and you know that I use Canon cameras, so I don't quite know what the nomenclature on your cameras are because I am not familiar with it. But I set my camera on automatic ISO, I set my camera on automatic white balance, and I set it on 250th of a second, and I leave it normally on F8.
Mm-hmm.
To all intents and purposes, and I said I have it set on the hyperfocal distance.
Yeah.
So I am ready to shoot my pictures no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be the best result, but it will give me a result which I can tweak in Photoshop to produce a really good image. And I think that's what most social photographers should be doing.
And for those people that don't know of the technique or are not familiar, maybe you could just explain what you mean by hyperfocal distance and hyperfocal focusing.
That's going to take a long time.
do it in 20 seconds.
It only works if you're using really a prime lens.
Mm.
So you, if you select the aperture and you turn the dedent to the infinity mark, and then you relate that to the distance that you're shooting at, somewhere in the middle of it, it's going to be about 15 to 20 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are going to use the aperture which synchronizes with it.
Mm. And so for people that have seen some, you know, if you've seen a particular, say, landscape shot or a seascape, and you thought it's amazing because the rock right at the absolute front of the picture is razor sharp, as is the boat on the horizon in the distance, chances are that will have used the hyperfocal technique because it gives you the optimum amount of focus front to back.
If you like, I'll work out how to do a little chat with you about nothing but the hyperfocal point.
Hmm.
Essentially, it is an easy way of keeping your camera set so you are able to take a picture without hesitation, without looking at anything. You just raise the camera, push the shutter, and you've got an acceptable image.
And someone like Cartier-Bresson
would have used it all the time.
Because he was renowned for literally, he used using his lightweight Leicas, of course, but he would literally be strolling through the street, always observing everything that was going around him, waiting for those opportunities. And he literally would pivot on his tiptoes, raise the camera, take a shot, whisper quiet cameras, and then just carry on walking. No one, half time, people never knew he took the shots. He didn't have to mess around with focusing.
He was the one who created something called the decisive moment.
Mm, absolutely.
And well, if you look at his pictures, they're superb. But he shot all his pictures on a standard 50mm lens. It was he shot on one of the early Leicas, and his pictures are beautiful.
So that just goes back to what we were saying before about not having to worry yourself with the technical side of things. Once you understand your cameras, once you understand what to expect from settings and what have you, it leaves you free to
concentrate on the image.
So let's wrap it up, Hugh. Let's go back to the original idea about social photography, shooting weddings. That was what we started off with. If you can shoot weddings, you can therefore be shooting photojournalism, you can shoot your documentary, any pictures that involve interaction with people.
I think to sum it up, I think that's exactly right. And I think that social photography is 80% people management.
Mm.
And that is persuading people to behave in a way that they would subsequently think to be quite extraordinary in order that you may get your pictures. And that is it's quite funny. If you have the camera, it gives you an authority. You can ask people to do the most ridiculous things, and because you're holding the camera and because you are actually in charge, they'll do it. I've never understood quite why.
Who was the photographer that got all the royals to jump up in the air? So these portraits of these royals.
I can't remember.
There's some excellent shots. I'll have to try and, whether I'll manage to do it in time for the show notes for this recording, I'm not sure of this show. But there was this photographer who, social society, should we say, photographer, and he was renowned for having a way with this way where he would be able to convince people to do things that maybe is out of their comfort zone. So, it's going to look lovely. And he managed it even with the royal family. He said, just stand there, and when I count to three, I just want you to jump straight up in the air. Don't have to bend your legs, just literally jump straight. So you got a line of all these royals stood there, also just in midair. It's rather good. I'll try and dig out some links and those hopefully will appear in the show notes. So once again, Hugh, thank you very much indeed.
I really encourage all of you to check out the various photographers whose names came up in our conversation. There are countless great examples of masterful photography produced under various conditions, all of which we can learn from. Of course, if you know of any other examples which you think would be of benefit to your fellow listeners, please do drop them in the comments section along with a link. You can check out all the show notes to this and other week's shows at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, of course I'm on Twitter at Giles Babbage. You can check out The Active Photographer Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivephotographer, or of course send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, have a great week, and I will speak to you all very soon.